California. This is Revolution. The guest today you'll be hearing speak is Dr. Charisse Burdenstelly. Usually when you hear the audio-only podcast, if it's not an audio dump from this live stream, it's just me and a guest. And we were trying to get Dr. Burdenstelly on the show for the live stream. It just didn't work out. We originally had her scheduled in January. Didn't work. Like, scheduling, sometimes with this stuff, it's a little difficult. So the original topic that we wanted to talk to Dr. Burdenstelly was about a review she wrote of a book called Cast that was actually very popular. And her review of Cast, you know, really called it out, and we wanted to kind of interrogate that. But it was kind of so far down the road. There were other things that were going on that, of course, she felt were a little more important. And one of which she definitely wanted to discuss was a woman that doesn't get a lot of light shown her way is Claudia Jones, who's a old school Communist Party member. I believe she was born in London, but grew up in the U.S. and was deported. No, she was born in Trinidad. I'm sorry. And deported to London because of her political activity. Some people say that her teachings or philosophy were kind of the precursor to what we now call intersectionality. And we definitely interrogated that. And I'm very excited for you guys to hear Dr. Burdenstelly's take on that. She has a podcast out now. There will be links to her show in the description of this show called The Last Dope Intellectual that I believe she does with Dr. Jared Ball, who's also going to be on the show soon. Another rescheduling situation. So I'm going to shut up now and get out of the way. So you guys can hear this really interesting interview with Dr. Burdenstelly. And we did go over. So when I do the audio-only podcast, we try to keep it about an hour. If there is time, we go over. I save that extra time for the patrons. So if you want to hear the entire interview, if you want to hear the entire interview from the previous week, then you have to become a patron. There are links in the description to become a patron. Also, we do live streams 3 days a week now, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. Tuesday and Thursday at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and Saturday at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. So I will get out of the way now and let you guys listen to our interview with Dr. Charisse Burdenstelly. She's an assistant professor and Mellon Faculty Fellow of Africana Studies and Political Science at Carleton College. She is a scholar of radical black critical and political theory, political economy, and intellectual history. She co-wrote a book with Dr. Gerald Horn about the life of W.E.B. Du Bois. So, good talk. Her show's dope. The Last Dope Intellectual. Her show's dope. So again, there's going to be links to the show, links to Dr. Burdenstelly's work. If you want to hear more, become a patron. And I am out. All right, we are live, and usually on the audio podcast, it's just me and a guest, but today I get to have my co-host with me, Pascal Robert, and also I would like to introduce to the show, she is a professor and now a podcast host, correct?
Yeah, it's a podcast. It's kind of like just on YouTube right now, but eventually we'll figure out how to get it elsewhere.
Oh, I will be more than happy to tell you and show you the easiest way to get up in different spots. Dr. Charisse Burden-Stelly.
The last dope intellectual.
That's me. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for agreeing to come on. We wanted to talk to you a while back, and you know, schedules and all on all that can be. We weren't able to do it, but it was right after your article on the Caste, your review rather on the Caste book came out, and we loved it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, the Caste book.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I said Caste. Sorry.
Yeah, it's about workers. Yeah, you know, it's so funny because I feel like a lot of people want to talk to me about that, but I'm over it. Like, I don't care about Isabel Wilkerson's work. I don't care about the book, and Cast is not something I engage in my scholarship, but I took particular umbrage with many things about that text, not least her dismissal of Oliver Cromwell Cox. So I responded. Now it's kind of
it was a fiery response.
It was an excellent response.
Thank you.
But we didn't bring you here today to talk about that. There were some other things that we definitely wanted to talk to you about. Before, when we were off air, you did go to the University of California, Berkeley, but you're from Arizona.
Yes, I am.
What part of Arizona?
Are you tracking me?
No, I've been all over this. I'm a touring musician, and I've been all over the state of Arizona more times than I can count.
I am from Tucson, Arizona.
You're from Tucson.
Yes.
There was a club there called, I think it changed its name so many times. Like the Flycatcher, I think, was one of the names it had. I want to say it's downtown on the same strip where kind of most of those college bars and clubs are. And I couldn't tell you the name of the street off the top of my head. Forest Street? I forget the name of the street. But I've definitely been to Tucson several times. Actually love Tucson, and kind of sad I haven't been back since the pandemic. Do you ever get a chance to go back?
Uh-oh. Is that my internet?
Yep. You're good, though.
Huh. Okay. So let me see. Hold on. That's weird. That doesn't really happen. Let me go in my room. Hold on just one second. Having those issues. Okay, hopefully it doesn't keep freezing. All right, sorry. Continue.
All good. So what I was asking is, or saying that I've been to Tucson several times as a touring musician, and kind of miss going back to Arizona. Made some great friends in Tucson. There was a club, I want to say, in the downtown area. There's like a strip of bars not too far from the college. And this one was called, I want to say, like the Flycatcher or some sort of lounge. It was a pretty decent sized club. And, had a ball there. I enjoyed Tucson. But Tucson to Berkeley is two very different places. And now you're in Chicago.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So how do you like snow compared to extreme heat?
You know, it's basically two sides of the same coin, I would say. And I got like progressively colder over time. So I went from Berkeley I did my dissertation fellowship at Amherst College in Massachusetts. And then I did my postdoc in Urbana, Champaign, Illinois. And then my first job is at Carleton College. I'm still there in Northfield, Minnesota. And then now I'm here on a fellowship. And it's actually colder in Minnesota than it is here. So
that it is.
Yeah.
Was that Northern Minnesota you were in?
I just think it's regular Minnesota. I don't know. It's like 40 minutes away from the Twin Cities. Magellan, like I don't know directions.
Minnesota is another one of those places that's really. I lived in North Dakota for a while, so I definitely know cold. Oh, wow. But I am a California native, and I don't get along with snow. So you are a much better person than me for continuing to live in these ridiculously cold climates.
Yeah, it's not too bad.
Pascal.
Yeah, I'm originally from the Northeast, so I'm from New York, and I went to law school in Boston. So I live in Miami now, so I've acclimated myself to not having any kind of tolerance for the cold West weather. So I applaud you for your ability to even cope with it at this juncture.
I'll be in Miami next week, actually. And I actually hate Miami. I hate the weather in Miami. Like, humidity makes me feel like I'm being oppressed. So I'm from a dry heat area, so that humidity just makes it's not. I can't.
There are a lot of things outside of humidity that are oppressive about Miami, but I could understand why you believe the weather. It's not that bad now because it's wintertime. It's pretty decent, but I can empathize with the cold weather, mm-hmm. but. I'm glad that we got you on because, it's been important for us to focus on the project of exposing our listenership to Black left politics and what is called the Black radical tradition. And I've perused some of your content online. I haven't read your book. I'm trying to actually get, the piece you did on Du Bois. But I applaud you for being able to hold up the banner of the Black radical tradition and Black left politics, materialist, dialectical materialist, anti-capitalist, anti-sectist, anti-imperialist politics that we know here at This Is Revolution is important to Black people and is a core part of Black political traditions in America and in the African diaspora. And the main reason why I think it's important for us to have you here is that, and I'm sure you're aware of this, there has been a contemporary attempt in the liberal media establishment, particularly in, I think there are some members of the Black chattering class who participated in this, who've made an effort to paint left anti-capitalist politics as a white phenomenon, particularly with the rise of Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. And, I took a profound umbrage to that and found it to be particularly noxious and almost a kind of notorious attempt to try to paint a politics that has been sort of an existential part of Black existence as alien to Black folk. I'd like you to elaborate for us in terms of that, how the Black radical tradition is a fundamental part of the Black political experience and why that's such a false narrative to make that politics seem like it's alien to the Black experience.
Well, I mean, so a lot of people who come to this term, the Black radical tradition, come to it through Cedric Robinson's book, Black Marxism, The Making of the Black Radical Tradition. That's also how they come to the term racial capitalism, by the way, but he does a much more expansive treatment of the Black radical tradition. And anyway, if you believe Robinson, then Black people have been resisting the forms of domination, subjection, oppression, exploitation that have constituted modernity or that have constituted the capitalist world system since at least transatlantic enslavement. And so that is to say that this form of radicalism, that is radicalism as a fundamental rejection of the structural and material and cultural foundations of, the modern capitalist system, that's constitutive of our experience. Now, that's not to say that all Black people are radical. In fact, most Black people are not radical. However, I think what can be confusing is that there's like a race radicalism, right? And then there's a sort of anti-capitalist radicalism. And I think that the race radicalism has been far more prevalent, where people are against white supremacy, but they're still capitalists. They still, I call this the but for logic, where they think that the US is actually the greatest country on earth, but for racism, right? Or but for anti-blackness. But then there are those, the people that, so my squad, the people I rock with, who are against not only white supremacy, but understand white supremacy as one enunciation of capitalism, imperialism, colonialism, and warmongering. And so these are people, I have some lists. I'm a list person. And because it's Black History Month, I'm just going to list a whole bunch of names, okay? So there's 10 Black women that I think that belong to this tradition that people may or may not know. Thelma Dale, Vicki Garvin, Claudia Jones, Dorothy Burnham, Louise Thompson Patterson, Esther Cooper Jackson, Elma Francois, Eslanda Good Robeson, Carlotta Bass, Tyra Edwards, right? These are people who are doing that work. They're doing organizing. They're doing movement building. They're attending conferences and gatherings. They are they're waging struggle at the point of production and sort of against things like legal lynchings, right? So like the Scottsboro case, for example, the case of Rosalie Ingram. So these are people who are part of that Black radical tradition, who understand the ways that there is no equality and there is no peace or freedom in the capitalist system. And it's always been a sort of small but powerful current within the Black experience. I have a whole bunch of other names I could read, but I focused on the women just because those tend to be the ones you don't know.
No, that's totally fine. We're
glad you focused on the women.
Yeah.
That's very important, because that's, you know, as a show on Black Left Politics that is hosted by two men, you know, it's going to be very easy to for us to not be to not be conscious of the role of Black women in this struggle if we don't make an attempt to do so. So it's very important for us, and we're very glad that you highlighted the role of Black women in this struggle, and we encourage it. As a matter of fact, I want to go to the next question. Since yesterday, one of the things you did was remind us of Claudia Jones's birthday, I would like you to take a moment to explain to our audience who Claudia Jones was, how she fits in this tradition, and talk about her importance. And then we're going to go into some of her politics and how it meshed into some of the contemporary philosophies that we have today. So please, Dr. Burton Steadley, you know, grace us with the history of who Claudia Jones was and why she's so significant.
Yeah, so I'll preface this by saying that I study a particular period in Claudia Jones's life, and this is when she's in the Communist Party of the United States of America, roughly between about 1935 and 1955. She's deported in 1955. But essentially, Claudia Jones is this revolutionary Black communist leader, theorist, organizer, and journalist. She was born in Trinidad, but migrated to the United States when she was very young. And, she is a working class, or was a working class person. And in fact, she developed an illness that affected her heart her whole life from working in a factory. And her mom actually died from doing that onerous labor. And so that was part of the development of her consciousness. And she joined the Communist Party after seeing the ways in which the CPUSA mobilized on behalf of the Scottsboro Nine, and also linked that Scottsboro case to the invasion of Abyssinia in 1935. And so she was very inspired by that activism and joined the Young Communist League and went on to join the CPUSA. She is a reporter for the Daily Worker, which is the newspaper of the CPUSA. She also published a great deal in Political Affairs, which was the theoretical journal of the party. And she was just amazing. Like, she's best known for this idea of triple oppression, because her most known article is an end to the neglect of the problems of the Negro woman. And I think that's largely because Angela Davis wrote about her, and specifically that piece in Women, Race, and Class. But she theorized about so much more. She theorized about Wall Street imperialism, and not only theorized, but organized against Wall Street imperialism, the rise of U.S. fascism after World War II, she organized on behalf of, you know, so she challenged, there's just so much stuff. She was deeply anti-war. She promoted the right of to self-determination of Black people in the South of the United States. And she was a strong supporter of workers' rights, and especially of women workers' rights, Black women's workers' rights. And so she was just radical, like, in every sense of the word. And thankfully, we know much more about her now because of the work of, largely because of the work of Carol Boyce Davies. Carol Boyce Davies actually put together her archive that's now at the Schomburg. People have written about her here and there previous to that, but it's largely due to the heavy lift of Carol Boyce Davies that we
left
know more
of Karl
about.
Marx. Great book, Left of Karl Marx.
So it's Left of Karl Marx is her biography, but then Carol Boyce Davies also edited Claudia Jones' Beyond Containment, which is the only compilation of most, if not all, of her theoretical writings.
Why do you think there's such a big disconnect between our people and any sort of knowledge of, like, the our affiliation with communist and socialist movements, especially in the 30s and 40s? I mean, before the New Deal, I believe the Communist Party has a million card carrying members.
I don't know what the numbers are, but
I think that was the
height. Yeah, that's the height of their of the membership, and the height of Black membership is in that Great Depression era. I think that there's two reasons, or at least two reasons, why we don't know more about that history. One is what I call intellectual McCarthyism, which is basically the erasure, obscuring, liberalizing, or demonization of Black people who are communist or communist or fellow travelers. And there's also an effort to sanitize those, or sort of discipline out the aspects of people's lives who were indeed in the Communist Party or affiliated. So somebody like W.B. Du Bois, for example, people will read or know about Souls of Black Folk, or even now sort of Black Reconstruction if you're on the left. But he wrote so much more and did so much more after that. Few people know that he was actually indicted by the U.S. government in 1951 for being an agent of a foreign power for his peace activism. Right. And the ways in which he connected peace activism with anti-colonialism, anti-imperialism, and, you know, racial equality. So we'll know about Du Bois, but we won't know those. You know, he joined the Communist Party in 1961 before relocating to Ghana. Paul Robeson, there was just something.
Yeah.
It's Black History Month. So, you know, these goony ass mainstream publications have their fucking Black history facts. And, you know, they had something about Paul Robeson, but did not mention, you know, it said he was controversial because he promoted human rights, but did not mention that he was a member of the Communist Party, that he was red baited and had his passport canceled and was called before HUAC, the House Committee on Un-American Activities, and other subversive activities control board because of his activism. So they say, you know, he was a great singer and he spoke a lot of languages and he was good at football, like, you know, that type of stuff, but they don't get into his politics. And so that's one reason. The other reason is, you know, probably the one thing the United States hates as much as Black people is radicals, period, because it's a racial capitalist society, which means that you have to keep Black people oppressed and you have to maintain a system of economic exploitation. And therefore, you hate the people who challenge economic exploitation, i.e. socialists and communists. And you hate the people who are trying to liberate themselves from their reduction to a category of super exploitation, i.e. Black folks. And so these are the people who historically you repress. So I think that that's why we don't know more. Or, you know, you say communists and people, you might as well have said, you know, serial killers.
Yeah. Like, no, what? it's getting a little better now, but it's still a bit of a bad word. Now, I don't know if you guys have seen it. I was talking to Pascal about this the other day. Will Smith has a new Netflix docuseries called Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen it?
No.
I mean, I'm saying this somewhat tongue-in-cheekly, like I'm not a fan of it, but basically it's another one of these boils down all the problems to the 14th Amendment and our lack of understanding to it. It doesn't really examine how that amendment even was a bit gutted. What is your take on people like
Killer Mike and even like the Will Smiths of the community, which have a, they have huge platforms and huge voices when it comes to, you know, the only way out is some version of Black capitalism.
You know, I just wish sometimes people would shut the fuck up as Praxis. That's how I feel about that. I wish they would use their large platform to amplify the voices of people who actually are about that action, who actually understand the way the economy works, who actually understand, who prioritize workers and poor people. Those are the people who we need to be asking. Those are the people who bear the brunt of the material conditions of our society. So, for example, there was something I want to say in Washington Post or something else about how people could pay their bills for 6 months with $1,400.
Who are those people?
In what fucking world? What bills? Not even talking about rent, but what, that's like a phone bill, maybe.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's like, when you're rich, you have no conception of what it actually costs to survive, let alone the Black tax and the poor tax, right? So if you overdraw your bank account, for example, you get taxed for not having money. $35, right? $35, whatever, right? You pay income tax. You not only pay income taxes, but you also just paying taxes on food, right? In ways that people who are in particular tax brackets don't pay the same types of taxes. And so it's expensive to be poor. And those are the ideas that we need to amplify. But these bourgeois Negroes who have no, you know, And Killer Mike, he might have a better conception than others, perhaps, but like his ideas are just trash, like a Black bank. And then when he's pushed about how a bank actually operates, he's like, well, you know, it's money and deposits. And it's like, shut the fuck up, you know? So I want to go to Will Smith for my entertainment, not for my politics. And maybe was Killer Mike a rapper or something? I don't know. Maybe he's just
he is a relatively successful rapper. And I mean, we could have a whole other show on you know, like cats like these and how their politics get kind of entangled in a certain subset of the petite left, and it becomes radicalized when it's not really that radical, in my opinion. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, the U.S. is so far right that it's radical for it's progressive for the U.S. But if you think about globally, it's like, you know, people elsewhere are like, those are your radicals. That's why y'all are suffering. Anyway.
So I wanted to move on to a part of something you were mentioning with Claudia Jones in terms of her theorization of triple oppression. And I want to connect that to a contemporary philosophy that has particularly come out of academia. And I want to ask you is that, first of all, do you agree that Claudia Jones's theory of triple oppression is the precursor to intersectionality? And I'd like to know, do you think that intersectionality has become a bourgeois feminist notion that has been appropriated by liberal elites in American society? And if you can define those theories and how they play off each other, I would appreciate that. Choose to.
Yeah, I don't know what the definition of intersectionality is. It's not my bag. I mean, what I know about intersectionality, my understanding of intersectionality is that when it was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, she was a lawyer. And essentially what she was trying, she was suing, I want to say it was a Ford plant, because Black women in particular were not getting promotions.
Right.
And she was pointing out that Black men on the one hand were getting promotions and white women were, but the way in which the law is codified, there's not a recognition of Black women as a particular group who are not white women or not Black men. And so objectively, that is it's a bourgeois project, right? It's a intervention in jurisprudence that's meant to garner recognition before the law. Our laws are liberal, period. Now, the way in which it's been radicalized or taken up after that is another matter. But if you look at the foundations of what where intersectionality came from, and I think the article is mapping the margins, that's what it is, period. She's suing the state for promotions, right? So one might argue that's a particular class project, not the state, excuse me, Ford Motor Company, I think. Triple Oppression, on the other hand, is about material conditions with an emphasis on structure, the emphasis on what I call structural location. It's a political economy argument. So basically, Claudia Jones is arguing that Black women are oppressed as women, as workers, and as Black folks. But what she does argue in that piece and into the neglect of the problems of the Negro woman is that the Negro question is prior to the woman question. So she understands the political economy of Blackness, so to speak, that there's something about being Black in the United States and in the way in which Black people are positioned in the U.S. capitalist mode of production that makes them particularly susceptible to a specific type of exploitation over and above the working class. And that being a Black woman exacerbates that. Now, what we have in terms of being a precursor, if you mean that it came before, sure. But we need to look at political projects. And what happens is that there's always this move in the academy to establish intellectual traditions, right? One, and there's a sort of a feminist intellectual tradition that's established that goes all the way back to, let us say, Mariah W. Stewart. And then every Black woman that did some sort of organizing or activism for Black women, irrespective of class, irrespective of ideology, irrespective of what the so what was, they ostensibly belong to this like Black women's intellectual tradition. So if we believe that logic, then sure, Triple Oppression is a precursor to intersectionality. Now, I think that what's important to note is that Claudia Jones wrote An End to the Neglect of the Problem of the Negro Woman in 1949. 1935, Cyril Briggs and Eugene Gordon wrote a piece called The Position of Negro Women, where they talked about the double handicap of Black women. This is in 1935, and they are talking about, I'm gonna read something from this, okay? Just a little paragraph. They say, in a society based on production for profit, to be both a woman worker and a Negro is to suffer a double handicap. The Negro woman worker is doubly victimized. She suffers both from the general discrimination against women workers and from her identity as a member of a nationality singled out by the ruling class for special plundering, persecution, and oppression. So they're using double as opposed to triple, because they take for granted, they're starting with the idea that women are workers, right? So the double is Negro and woman. 1936, Louise Thompson Patterson writes Toward a Brighter Dawn, which actually comes out of a discussion that happened at the during the National Negro Congress in 1936. But she uses the term triple exploitation. So that's 1936. That's about, 13 years before Claudia Jones's piece, right? Claudia Jones then talks about triple oppression. Now, I'm a political theorist, so part of what I'm working out is the difference between triple oppression and triple exploitation, and looking at the ways in which they're argued out, and seeing if there's a sort of a difference in what's being argued out in Claudia Jones and Louise Thompson Patterson. My hypothesis is there is. But anyway, you got triple exploitation, triple oppression. Then you have double jeopardy. Later on, so this is Fran Beal, and I want to say this is 1968. She writes this piece like, to be Black and be female, something about double jeopardy, right? So jeopardy is a sort of move from this language of oppression or exploitation. Then you got triple jeopardy. And so there's this woman, Deborah K. King, she writes this article about triple jeopardy. Then you have intersectionality. So there's already these sort of interim steps. So there's the sort of jeopardy step, so to speak, between exploitation and intersectionality. And these steps are sort of happening as feminism, Black feminism, begins to rise as a sort of prominent ideology. So, one might argue, I mean, so that's how I would narrate it. I would say intersectionality and triple oppression or triple exploitation are different political projects, but they all happen to deal theoretically with race, class, and gender. So do with that what you may.
I'll take that. I'd like to interrogate that in a larger project that we were talking about here at This Is Revolution, about the concept of how the Black liberation struggle, quote unquote, is trying to be reconciled with American exceptionalism in the post-Biden to Harris era. So from the rise of the Obama presidency to the current administration of Biden-Harris, there has been a celebration by segments of the Black population, particularly liberals, in the increased racial diversity in the left flank of the ruling class. There is a sense that liberal elites among the Black people are trying to reconcile the Black liberation struggle, quote unquote, and even that term can be considered problematic, with American exceptionalism. Can you show how such notions of reconciling Black identity with American exceptionalism are antithetical to the quote-unquote Black radical tradition?
Well, Black identity is not antithetical.
Choose what you think is more appropriate, the Black liberation struggle or Black identity. I would say the Black liberation. But I would make the argument, quite frankly, that there's an attempt to reconcile Black history overall with American exceptionalism, with the rise of the way in which racial identity is used to further the Democratic liberal project post-Obama, quite frankly, when you're seeing things like, you know, Chucks and Pearls, Black Girl Magic, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we can talk about the gendered way in which I believe Black female identity is being weaponized to buttress Democratic liberal projects as well. But there's an overall kind of celebratory nature that we're seeing amongst Black, particularly Black people who are, you know, liberal adherents to the Democratic Party, that, oh, we have arrived, this is wonderful, the kind of Black faces in high places, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll be very frank, for me, it's kind of nauseating to see, and I think it demonstrates what we often talk about as being part of the 50-year counter-revolution. But I'd like you to elaborate on how this kind of posturing is so antithetical to Black left, the history of Black left politics, and how those actors that you were so honorably mentioning viewed the Black situation in the past.
Mm-hmm. So if I'll just complete my thought that I started, Black identity is very much reconcilable, I would say. So identity, the construction of identity, right, I think is compatible with American exceptionalism. But the structural and material realities of Blackness and of Black people are not compatible with that, right? Identity as a political category. So politics rooted in identity is different than identity rooted in politics, right? Because a politics rooted in identity is very much compatible with US empire because it's essentially about integration. It's essentially about a linear progress narrative. It is essentially about being included into the state apparatus or into U.S. society. So what I was talking about earlier, the but-for logic. And so one of my comrades, Erica Keynes, talks about identity reductionism, where, and Kamala Harris is an example of this, whereby identity is the only thing that matters. It does not matter the ideology. It does not matter the politics. It does not matter that this woman laughed maniacally about throwing parents in jail for their children's truancy. That shit don't matter. What matters is that she's Black or biracial or whatever, you know, however people identify her, and that she is a woman. So that's identity reductionism. That's absolutely compatible. And in fact, reifies empire because racial regimes change over time. And basically at this moment, the racial regime requires that you have a few chips in the cookie, so to speak, to legitimate what's happening. So the United States can, so there can be this idea of moving from slavery to Jim Crow, to civil rights, to, you know, this sort of post-racial inclusion. And that is fundamentally problematic because that does not tell, you know, the complete story. And so there's a way in which I would say Kamala Harris and Susan Rice and even Neera Tanden and whatever that Black man name is that was on the Raytheon board and was also like a 5-star general. Now he's the head of what? The Department of Defense?
Yeah.
Black dude, whatever his name is. This is intersectional imperialism.
Ooh, right? I love it.
And so we have a, you know, we have a saying in our community, all skin ain't kin. And this is precisely, like, there can be an assumption on the one hand, a liberal assumption, that because somebody looks like you, they have your best interest in mind. But if we understand that Black people are heterogeneous and that there's an intra-racial class stratification, then we understand the ways in which those people can be, are exactly, they have the exact politics and the exact orientation of the ruling class. They simply happen to look different, right? They believe in Black capitalism, or they believe, you know, they either believe in Black capitalism or believe that Black people can be equally integrated into the capitalist system. Equally meaning that equal opportunity, right? Of course, they don't want all them Blacks to be, to make it. They need, you know, they believe in the majority of people being poor, but they believe that there should be, let us say, 13% of Black people in the ruling class because it matches the population, that sort of thing, right? They're still anti-poor, they're anti-people, they're imperialists and capitalists. They just happen to be in a particular body. And again, what can be confusing about this is that historically, there is race radicalism. But that race radicalism is not rooted in any structural critique other than the fact that white people should stop being racist so that Black people can actually compete in this system as it is, but on equal footing. And I would say that's Kamala Harris in a nutshell. Her identity is enough. Her identity is her radicalism, they would say, right? That the fact that she could even make it to the second highest position in the land is proof, you know, it's proof that of her progressivism, and not only that, proof of the progressive nature of the United States, never mind the calamity that was Obama, right? The drone, you know, the droner in chief, the deporter in chief, the poor shamer in chief, right? We didn't learn from that. But now it's like, you know, well, Black girl magic. Well, the future is female. So we expect something different from Kamala. But as, you know, one might say, you can wish in one hand and shit in the other and see which one fills up first.
That is one of my favorite sayings, by the way.
So.
I'm enjoying the depth and the succinct, pull no punches nature of your answers. You know, I'm glad we have you here to bring, basically, you know, bring the ruckus. And back to the next question I want to ask you, and I want your thoughts, is can you share your thoughts on how the internal class stratification within Black society is an obstacle to the more transformative political vision for the majority of Black folk who are working class? I've written generally for Black Agenda Report, and we have a concept that we call the Black misleadership class, most would call it the Black political class, and particularly in this period of what I call the 50-year counter-revolution since the movement era of the 60s, we've seen the burgeoning of this Black political class, yet we've seen a diminution in terms of the return on investment that Blacks have gotten in terms of material quality of life as the exponential growth of this political class develops. I, and you may disagree with me, say that Black politics, particularly Black electoral politics, is a class politics. And the class that it represents is not the interests of the majority of Black people, but the interests of an elite cadre. I'd like to hear your thoughts on how this particular class stratification either has in the past or even particularly today works as an obstacle to the transformative politics that the majority of Black people who are working class need to improve their condition.
Well, it's interesting that you say like a 50-year counter-revolution, because somebody like Gerald Horn would argue that is a, you know, whatever, a 400-year counter, 1776, what is that, 300 years, 250-year counter-revolution, right? He talks about the counter-revolution of 1776, that we are in a fundamentally, constitutively reactionary and counter-revolutionary settler colony that has inflection points that can move the needle forward. But what we have to understand about that is those gains are wholly reversible, right? So reversibility is a condition of Blackness, one might argue, if you're getting theoretical about it. All the gains are wholly reversible. But to answer your question, so there's this man called J. Lauren Mottori. He is an anthropologist at Duke, and he has this concept of ethnological schadenfreude. And I don't think he came up with it, but essentially, but he has a whole book about it where he talks about how oppressed groups, the ways in which they're oriented towards other oppressed groups is to sort of displace their shame and their sort of oppression onto other groups to distance themselves, right? To make it seem like that's the group that ought to be oppressed because we are closer to whatever dominant group, right? So ethnological starting point. And so basically, I'm writing a manuscript where I'm just thinking with regard to Black people, I'm talking about class Schadenfreude, right? Which is a similar concept. But what happens is that because of the condition of class formation within the Black community, whereby there's always been a managerial class, but it's a dependent class, right? It's sort of like the comprador class in the global South, where it's basically their lesser capitalists, and it's the difference between the very, very rich and the very poor is much, much smaller than in the dominant society. And so there's a way in which the Black elite, the distinction has been mostly cultural and educational or aspirational. And so there's a way in which the upper class distinguishes itself from the, you know, from workers and poor people. Primarily, now it's more so through Black flight, but also through these cultural logics. And this is where you get things like respectability politics and racial uplift. And so now I would say what's different, what's different now is that the stratification is becoming more magnified, whereby the Black elite no longer lives in the communities with Black people, with the, you know, regular Black people. Because of Jim Crow, everybody was in a similar proximity. Now that's no longer the case. And so a lot of these politics and policies that are being advocated by the misleadership class or by the Black elite, they're completely abstracted from the actual realities of regular Black people, because they don't have to bear the brunt of it. They don't have to see the effects of advocacy for policing, for example, because they don't live in those neighborhoods. And so they have either their own Black elite enclaves or they're in more integrated communities. And so I would say that what that means is that they have a less of a vested interest in advocating the well-being of the Black community as a whole. But again, this is a feature of the Black condition as such, right? Somebody like Booker T. Washington was an early model of the managerial function of the Black elite and of the Black middle class. They serve as a buffer between the masses of Black people and regular society. And so sometimes they play a brokerage role, but increasingly, because again, they don't have to sort of bear the brunt of many of these policies, they can become more draconian and more in terms of politics and policy have more in common with the ruling elite than with the Black masses. And this doesn't mean that race doesn't matter, because again, they're a dependent petty bourgeoisie. But there's a way in which class has a greater effect on unity, notions of unity or solidarity.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about that. I wrote a piece for Black Agenda Report a while back called The Fallacy of Racial Kinship Politics. And you may agree or disagree with this theory, but the larger point that I was making to kind of continue off on your position is that because of this class stratification and the fact that these individual actors, these Black petite bourgeois or professional managerial class or comprador class, you know, if I like using the term comprador, acts their class politics out in a way in which they're vested in their particular interests that oftentimes don't fulfill the needs of the majority of Black people who tend to be working class and poor, that the fallacy of racial kinship allows them to use their racial makeup as an ideological unifier, when in reality their material class project is antithetical to the needs of most Black people, and how racial kinship actually becomes a duping process in which Black people support them, saying things like, oh, we can't talk bad about Black politicians, or, you know, we don't want to talk bad about Black folk, when in reality the class interests of these individuals is actually what's more prevalent than their racial makeup. So I'd like to ask you, do you think that racial kinship in terms of how it works out politically, particularly in American society, is a fallacy? Or do you think that the notion of putting race first is still a concept that should be adhered to out of the kind of Black power politics that we had in the late 60s, early 70s?
So would you say Clarence Thomas is a good example of that, how a lot of black people kind of rallied behind Clarence Thomas.
Well, I wouldn't use Clarence Thomas.
I don't think black people rally behind that handkerchief head. Like, I think that black people might rally around a Kamala or an Obama. I think that, you know,
I would push back on that and say, yeah, 1991, the guy that was replacing Thurgood Marshall
that was 30 years ago. I think politics are not static in that way. Right. I think that I think more and more there's a pushback against particular types of black conservatives, especially if they're not black nationalists. Now, I think there's a particular promotion of conservative nationalism that's still ubiquitous. But I think that, for example, black people ain't coming for Obama unless you're on the radical left, right? The fringe left like me and everybody else. And so I think it's more of the black liberals. And the other thing too, it might be for particular black conservatives who are part of a black conservative tradition, but these current black conservatives are not part of a black conservatives that's rooted in the black community. They espouse white conservatism, they're just black. So somebody like Candace Owens, she's not part of an actual endogenous black conservative tradition in my estimation. Now, I believe in race politics. However, I think it needs to come from below because there is still, if not a uniformity, a deep consonance in the structural material conditions of Black working class and poor people. And that's the majority. What I don't believe is that these bourgeois Negroes need to be the quote unquote leaders. Number one, I don't think we need any more leaders. It's only Black people who need a fucking leadership class. No other group has this phenomenon. No other group. And so I think that needs to be flipped on its head. But I believe in race solidarity. But I also believe that race or blackness needs to be understood in material terms. And as well as culture in the sort of Cabralian sense, right? But I still believe that white people have, you know, a cross class race solidarity politics, period.
If that's
a militarized identity politics, period. And a lot of leftists like to try to skirt around that, like, well, it's, you know, it's economic insecurity. They're fucking racist. They're white supremacists, period. And as long as that's the reality of the majority of or a plurality of white people in the society, I believe we also need to have a particular type of race solidarity rooted in ideas of Black liberation and socialism, but then work in solidarity and an allyship with other racialized, oppressed, and marginalized groups. That's my perspective.
So you don't believe in racial coalition with white people at all?
I just said we need to be in solidarity and allyship with other marginalized, oppressed, and poor people. And for the white people who see themselves as such, sure. But I don't believe that that's the majority or plurality of white folks. So,
I think that's. I understand the assessment you're making completely. No.
Yeah, I know that. You know, you seem a little bit more Reedian than me. I bang with Adolf Reed, and I think that what the work of Adolf Reed and, you know, Cedric Johnson and the rest of their cabal, their group.
Cabal.
I love.
You are speaking to that cabal right now, ma'am.
Right. I love Cedric Johnson. He actually, you know. I love all of them. What I always say is that Adolf Reed keeps my race politics sharp so that they don't descend into race hustling. And so that I do have a critique of Black neoliberalism and of the Black elite and the Black ruling class, or not even the ruling class, they're not rulers, but the Black managerial class. But I do still believe in a particular type of a specificity. I believe in super exploitation. And again, going back to the people that I read and the people that I root my work in, there is something specific to the black condition, period.
I don't think, you know, or Cedric would deny that. And I think that if you're a good Marxist, you will realize that one of the things that makes Black people, particularly in a capitalist society in America, is that we are relegated to surplus redundant labor, but for the necessity of maintaining the fiction in the minds of the majority that capitalism doesn't apply them negatively. So you're always going to see Black people disproportionately affected by capitalism in a negative way.
Reed wouldn't say disproportional. He would get on you for using the proportionality. You know this. And also, I'm a bad Marxist. I'm a Rodneyist. So I'm a bad Marxist because I believe in the Negro question being central. So I'm a bad Marxist. I own that. Who's
on check? I mean, Walter Robb. I mean, listen, I don't think you're a bad Marxist at all. But I mean, I think that we're making these are debates between fellow travelers that are issues of degree. I don't think that someone like Adolf Reed and Cedric Johnson spend their time writing about black politics and political thought because they don't care about poor and working class black people. In other words, I think that his solutions might be slightly different than yours. And their face in a racialized project might be different than yours, but I don't think that we should be antithetical in terms of our overall goal, overall analysis of how we realize the ideological superstructure of a capitalist society affects poor and working class black people. And I think there's more in agreement than disagreement in terms of
the way. I do think that Reed could have an internationalist perspective. I think that he does not, and that's not, I'm not dragging him, but that's objective facts. If you read his work, you know, and I think that there might be a different type of analysis when you look at the international situation.
I think,
as opposed to simply national. So
when you talk to him personally, he does have international kind of a worldview, but I would agree with you. It has not been demonstrated in his writing. I don't disagree with that. There's no question at all that it's not something that is evident in his writing, but on a personal level, he definitely has strong opinions, particularly in issues in Brazil and other third world and developing countries. But there's no question that his writing does not demonstrate a strong anti-imperialist, internationalist worldview without a question at all. He basically is an Americanist in that regard. So I will not deny that. And I think that's a fair criticism. That's a very fair criticism. But, I consider myself more of a student of Bruce Dixon than Adolf. I am a very big acolyte of Adolf's work. And both Bruce and Adolf agreed in many ways. But one of the consequences of writing for Black Agenda Report for over a decade is that you're very much influenced by the revolutionary nationalists as well, who I love those brothers and I've learned very much from those brothers. But I am not a nationalist. I differ from them in terms of the concept of, you know, internal colonial theory. I'm not a big fan of that theory. But, you know, at the same time, I think in terms of the overall reality of how capitalism affects black people adversely, as I explained to you, how I view in terms of capitalism reducing black people just in larger numbers to surplus redundant labor and the consequences of that. Yeah, I agree with them. And I think capitalism is innately racialized because of that reality. So I wouldn't disagree with them at all in that regard. So I think that we're all more than fellow travelers in that position. So, I appreciate the criticism. I'm willing to accept the criticism from someone who realizes that the overall enemy is capitalism, racism, and imperialism, and sexism, and we have to challenge all four.
Mm-hmm. So this is not going to be video, but I just want to let your audience know I got my Kente cloth shirt on. And yeah. I'm black, blackity, black. And that's just going to be what it is. And so that's my perspective. I did not come to Marxism through Marx or Lenin. I came to Marxism through black people, through the people that I mentioned earlier, along with, you know, Amilcar Cabral, Frantz Fanon, Walter Rodney, of course, both Walter and Patricia Rodney, Alpheus Hunton. The list goes on and on. And so that is why. And then I then circle back to, you know, Marx, Lenin, Bukharin, and others. So I think that it's important for me to state that because, number one, I don't think that that was backwards or wrong or anything. But that's my intellectual lineage. And so, you know, race will always be at the center for me, or racial processes of racialization will always be. That's my starting point. It will never be epiphenomenal or a function of class or whatever. So
my simple position on that, and I've said this, is that I have no problem with making a race a functional integral cog in the nature in which oppression exists in American society. But my necessary question is that when you're developing a politics, unless you are going to say you're going to mile the black elites, how do you create a race politics that does not create a position where they are the comprador elite becoming managers of the affairs of the black poor working class? I mean, I'm down for that kind of race project, but I don't know. I don't see too many black people who are willing to admit that we have to extricate these petit bourgeois Negroes from the reality of the life of the black proletariat in order to actually have them create a politics that's based on their material needs.
Well, it depends on what Black people you talk to. I would say the Black people I talk to, we know that's part of the class nature of
the black
reality, right? But it's our responsibility and our historical task to make that plain, right?
You can and so black it's not left in a large gymnasium. I mean, in terms of America,
but I would even say people that are not regular people who are not outwardly leftist as such. I think that if you ask them, like, are these people representing you well? They would say no, right? If you ask them. I think that we just have to ask the right questions. And I think that more people than you think will realize that, you know, the Jay-Z's of the world and the Kamala's of the world, like once we get through this identity reductionism, I really think there is a way in which people can see that, you know, again, all skin ain't kin. And so, this is the work. But I believe in Black people. And I, like I said, I believe in a race politics that is Black, that is poor and worker led. That's not even led by people like me. Like, you know, I like to think I commit class suicide, but effectively, like, I'm the petty bourgeoisie. So that's just my perspective, and I'm always going to believe it. And who can check me? Adolf?
You said ADOS or
Adolf? I think you said ADOS.
Said ADOS or Adolf?
ADOS. Come on. No. Adolf Reed.
Oh, okay. I thought you said ADOS.
I don't have any comments about ADOS, by the way. I don't need them in my mentions, so don't even ask me.
Hey, my mom is one of those people, and I have to deal with that on a daily basis. So
I'm a Pan Africanist. That's all I could say. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't get that whole shtick, and I'd kind of give a fuck what those people want to say to me on the internet.
So what's next,
people say some great. People get really emboldened by the internet to say some
absolutely.
Crazy shit.
The Academy and the internet are two places where people say shit that in real life would get them beat down. Expeditiously, and it's really wild. It's very wild. So I don't know
if you know the rapper Akala from the UK, who wrote a really good book about race and class called Natives. Definitely dealing with race and class in the UK, but he was getting interviewed by a fellow rapper, and his friend was asking him. He's like, "Man, I see you in these interviews with these like white conservatives, man, and they say just the craziest shit to you." And Akala says, you know, I have to check myself from time to time to not fuck these people up for for the boldness in the shit that they say. Because, you know, he debates people like Tommy Robinson, that what is the name of that group in the UK that he's a part of, Pascal?
Not UKIP. UKIP is the party.
Not UKIP. It's like a white identity movement in the UK that was pushing against Muslims.
That's a waste of time. Those debates are a waste of time. Like when Black radicals, even, you know, what was it? What's his name? Mark Lamont Hill was debating Candace Owens. That shit is a waste of time. Like, I don't understand why. And especially the whites, when people be debating like Bill O'Reilly and shit. Why? Like, we have work to do. That's silly to me. These debates between me and you, important, right? Because we're trying to think about how to approach the work. Debates between me and these fucking sheet wearing conservative neo proto fascists. Why? That's petty bourgeois Negro shit to me.
I think that the Black conservatives, particularly though, have to be dealt with, because unfortunately there's a certain segment of Black people, you know, who still find that reactionary politics as the answer to the question, because, you know, there's not a lot of love given in terms to Black left thought. You know, there's still lots of Black people. You say Marxism, communism, socialism. Yeah. You're like, oh, that's a white thing. Why are you, you know, why are you following that white man?
You know, I the reason why I feel you, Charisse, 100%, because I don't do the debate thing. I don't really dig it on that level. I don't dig it. But then again, when I hear people that I know and like say in my personal life, say repeat Candace Owens rhetoric because those people push back against the Democratic Party. And a lot of us, not all of us, right? Not the people on this podcast, and probably not the people in our political sphere that we have, but we know people that just believe that there's two parties. There's a Democratic Party and there's a Republican Party, and the Democratic Party is for us and the Republican Party is for them. And when Candace Owens pushes back on some broken clock is right twice a day on the perils of the Democratic Party, and especially the way they treat Black women, there is a subset of Black women that go, you know what, right on. And that's a problem. Look, and she has to be called out.
I know a pimp when I see one. Okay? And there ain't none at a time I'm listening to no motherfucking pimp. No, I don't care. I get it. But what I, your point is taken, pimping notwithstanding. That's a failure on our part. We need to do a better job of conveying that there is an alternative. We need to stop. We being the Black left need to stop with the lesser of two evilism. So that's a failure on our part. But again, if one believes in dialectics, like this is the work, right? And we are in a particular moment of opening, right? Right now, we are in a particular moment when the contradictions are extremely high and extremely laid to bear for all to see. And so that's what we're supposed to be doing, right? You know, Candace Owens has, no, it was a, I did not swear. I would.
You call it a Freudian slip.
But the thing is, history and momentum are on her side because we live in a reactionary right-wing society. But, and this is why, to your first question, it is important to know people like Claudia Jones and Paul Robeson and Dorothy and Alpheus Hunton and Esther V. Cooper and James Jackson, et cetera, because these are people who are doing it against extraordinary odds. And so we are just taking up that mantle now. So I'll hop off my soapbox, but I believe that with all my heart.
No,
I believe we're right.
No, this whole show, this whole thing exists because I wanted to show our people or talk about a Black left that doesn't get talked about outside of February, and then
it gets talked about in February that often.
Well, no, February is the the first ashy Black person to invent the wheel. You know, George Washington Carver, and you know, some type of sanitized notion of Rosa Parks. Like that's Black. Yeah. It's like these random. Yeah. Yes, that's
no,
how
I
the communist calls it African Liberation Month, and I'm with that because we need to shift the narrative. To mm-hmm. talk about the people who matter to us and who matter to us because these are people who are doing the work that we're trying to do now. So, what else?
I'd like to ask you, this may be a controversial question.
Hey, we got time. Hey,
you better
time
quit
to pray.
Beefing with me. Sorry. You better quit starting messing with me.
Hey, we have talked for 1 hour and this has been a great conversation. This has been Dr. Charisse Burdenstelly. If you want to hear more, you're going to have to be a patron.